Chapter 26. Right after breakfast on the 21st, Emmy Van Alden and I started out in the jitney for Verlaine, where she was holding classes and I was visiting. As we got close, we began to meet refugees fleeing from Aum. You can't imagine the state of those roads. The army retreating, the infantry so tired it hurt to look at them, great guns, wagons full of supplies and equipment, ambulances evacuating hospitals, and along with them all, hundreds and hundreds of refugees, pushing wheelbarrows or leading a mule with a wagon if they were lucky enough to have one. In spite of all the racket, it never entered our heads that the Boche could possibly break through. Miss Alice Patton, class of 1910, to her sister, Mrs. Gilbert Thomas. March 1918. Grecourt, France. Emmy knew something was wrong even before they got to Verlaine. The road from Aum to Verlaine was crowded with people, dozens of them, hundreds of them, heads down, shoulders bent, old women pushing wheelbarrows piled high with linens, agitated mothers pulling children by the hand, trying to keep out of the way of the military trucks bumping toward the front, the dispatch riders on their motorbikes whizzing to and fro. "What's happened?" Emmy called out, leaning out the side of the truck. No one really seemed to know. All they knew was that the Boche were coming, and they were getting out, as far as the road would take them. "Have you been evacuated?" asked Emmy, exchanging an alarmed look with Alice, who had pulled the jitney to a stop by the side of the road. They hadn't been evacuated. They were just leaving. The army was too busy to bother with them, and why should they bother waiting for the British army? It was safer just to go. Alice's lips were very white. "Do you think it's serious?" she whispered. "I don't hear the guns." Emmy looked at the people with their bundles, all their worldly possessions piled on their backs. "It might just be an excess of caution, but maybe we ought to go to Aum and find out, so we can tell our people what to do." If Aum was in danger, but it probably wasn't, Emmy told herself hastily. Will was there holding the line. Will and all those brave boys whom they'd had to tea and impromptu dances with a temperamental Victrola and rubber boots for dancing slippers. "If you go on to Verlaine," Emmy told the woman she'd been talking to, "you can get something to eat and drink, and we'll take you on after if you need to go on." A camion honked sharply at them. All right," muttered Alice, her hands trembling on the wheel. She'd had a harder time than any of them with the bombardment. Emmy had found her resorting more than once to her little silver flask of sherry, writing endless letters home that she always crumpled up again. Alice managed to get them back on the road, weaving her way between the refugees going one way and trucks going the other. They were all of a quarter of a mile from Aum, but at this rate, it would take them an hour. It was worse than Fifth Avenue on an opera night. "What's taking so long?" "Ambulances," said Alice, her lips barely moving. "Can't you see them? Up there." The jitney inched forward, and Emmy saw it, the steady line of ambulances bumping into Aum, battle-scarred, shell-marked, mud-smeared ambulances, tires shot out, riding on their rims, pulling forward one by one to a makeshift casualty clearing station. Alice swung the jitney to the side so they could go around, past the row of ambulances, into the town. As they passed, Emmy could see stretchers being unloaded. Endless, endless rows of men on stretchers. Men in pain, moaning and calling out. Men with limbs twisted at strange angles, faces covered with mud and gore, as the stretcher bearers worked stolidly on, carrying more and more and more. Emmy heard someone make a noise and realized it was her. In all their time in the war zone, she had never seen anything like this. The copper stench of blood clung to the back of her throat. Thick black flies buzzed around them, their sound horrible in her ears. On and on and on they came, the blessés, each ambulance turning and going back to the front for more, as Tommies, blank-faced with exhaustion, wrestled with sticks and canvas to make more tents to house the onslaught of wounded. Was Will somewhere in one of those tents? Emmy had never asked him, she realized with sudden panic. She'd never asked him what exactly they did at the front, where he was to be stationed, how he was to serve. They'd never talked about that, only about nonsense. He was in the Durham Light Infantry, he'd told her that much, with its insignia of a bugle surmounted by a crown. But she had no idea what any of that actually meant, where he was, what his part had been in whatever battle had taken place. Why hadn't she asked? Because he couldn't tell her, because he wasn't allowed to tell her, and because neither of them had wanted to think about it, about the reality of all this. Only the newly harrowed fields and the latest exploits of Zélie's pet goat and the woman Emmy had found in Douy who hadn't any bed, but somehow, for some inexplicable reason, had 10 chairs, all piled one on top of the other. I think I'm going to be ill, said Alice faintly. She was holding the steering wheel very hard, her hands as white as wax. Emmy took one of Alice's hands between her own. You're not going to be ill. Let's go to headquarters and find out what's going on. At headquarters, everyone was packing up, hastily sweeping documents into dispatch boxes, yanking out telephones and telegraph wires, running this way and that, and bumping into each other. Emmy managed to catch the arm of a lieutenant who had been to tea at Grey Corps. She couldn't remember his name, but he had a friendly, freckled face. What's happened? She asked.
Oh, miss. He couldn't remember her name either. You didn't hear? The Boche have pushed down from San Quentin. We're trying to pack up and move HQ to Nell before the Boche get here.
How long? Emmy thought of all those people on the road, all the people in Verlaine and Epeville and Villette who had no idea what was coming toward them.
I don't know. You'd have to ask, what is this, a tea party?
His commanding officer strode in, staring at Emmy and Alice with unconcealed fury. It was a horrible major who had interviewed them all back in January to make sure they weren't spies.
What in the devil are you doing here? This is no place for women. We sent a messenger. You were meant to clear out, not walk right into the path of the ruddy Germans.
Wait, Emmy grabbed him by the arm. What about the neighboring villages? Have they been warned to evacuate?
How the devil would I know? They're like rats. They can tell when to leave the sinking ship. But you clearly can't, so I'm telling you now. Get out.
They got.
We need to get back to Grey Corps and warn them, said Alice, turning the crank of the jitney with all her might. No.
Emmy wasn't sure where the certainty came from. She just knew. She knew what she had to do, even if she was scared out of her wits.
Didn't he say someone had sent a messenger? They'll be all right at Grey Corps, but the people of Verlaine won't. Once the Germans take Aum, the next place they'll go is Verlaine. We can't just leave them there.
Alice paused, her hand on the crank.
But the major told us to get out.
He told us to get out of Aum. He didn't say anything about Verlaine.
They'd been with their people this long. They couldn't abandon them now.
What he doesn't know won't hurt him. The British Army clearly has a great deal on its hands right now. I say we leave them to their work and we do ours. We can move people in the jitney faster and farther than any of them can go on foot.
Alice straightened, her eyes meeting Emmy's.
We'll need gasoline, she said,
and Emmy felt her heart lift, a crazy sort of energy pulsing through her.
I think I know where we can get some.
The boys at the supply dump were packing up, but when Alice explained the need, they stumped up 50 gallons of essence, strictly under the table, no ration books required.
Saves us carrying it, they said.
And Emmy had to resist the urge to hug them. All along the road to Verlaine, they stopped to pick people up. Women with toddlers clinging to their hips, an old woman clutching a sack of linens, an elderly man hobbling with a stick who told them he had lost his leg in the last war against the Prussians, and he'd be damned if he'd let them take another one. Until the springs of the jitney were groaning with the weight, and Alice warned Emmy that the old truck couldn't possibly manage another. They decanted their burden in the town square of Verlaine, urging them to wait, that they would take them on farther when they could. They'd never seen Verlaine like this before. The square was pulsing with troops and refugees, with frightened people running out of their houses, begging for news. When the jitney pulled in, they were inundated with a rush of children.
Emmy hugged and hugged and hugged them, holding as many of them close as she could, telling them not to worry, it would all be all right, they would make it all right, and could they please, please tell their mothers to pack up anything they needed and come to the square? A horrible booming filled the air, closer than any guns Emmy had ever heard before, followed by a dreadful whistling noise. "A shell," whispered Alice, staring at the sky as though she might see it, even though the mist had burned off and the sky was fine and clear and there was nothing at all to be seen. "That has to be a shell." They'd never been close enough to hear the actual shells before, only the thrum of the guns firing them. Verlaine was only 3 miles from Om, and the Boche were nearly at Om. Emmy could feel her palms go cold with sweat. A girl started crying, and Emmy cuddled her close, a toddler boy bumping his head against her shin to get her to hold him, too. She wasn't strong enough for this. She wanted to curl up with the children, curl up and shake. But she couldn't. They were depending on her, these children, all of them. Emmy forced back her panic. What would Kate do? She had to think like Kate.
"Take them to Ayrshire. It's only..."
Emmy did the mental math.
"It's 8 miles. That should be far enough to be safer, but not so far we can't get there and back. If you ferry the first load, I can pack people up. We'll be faster that way." "All of you," she said to the children. "Go now. Tell your mothers it's time to go. I have candies in my bag for everyone who does what I say."
The magic word had its usual effect. Propelled by the power of sweets, the children scattered to their homes, the homes they had worked so hard to rebuild and that the Germans were threatening again. They had worked so hard for this, all those long, back-breaking days of hauling furniture and tacking up canvas and tramping through miles of mud and fighting with the trucks when they broke down. And now it was all going to be knocked down again in moments, all their hard, hard work. Anger lent Emmy new energy. If the Kaiser thought they'd roll over, he had no idea. They'd get everyone out, everyone, and then come back and build it up again, even better this time, and serve the Kaiser right. He had no business being here in the first place. Buoyed with righteous fury, Emmy stalked to the nearest home, a hut that had once been a tabak, and began the lengthy process of coaxing the inhabitants to pack enough, but only just enough, and no, they couldn't really take the stove with them, and yes, it was a lovely stove, but it would be here for them, hopefully, when they got back. She helped them pack their clothes and chase their hens. She held babies and soothed anxious children as the shells whistled overhead and the guns got louder and louder, and Emmy wondered where on earth Alice was and why it was taking her so long. Alice came back from her first run with the jitney, loaded with bread, milk, and eggs.
"For the refugees, we can at least give them a solid meal. I stopped back home," she added defensively. "That's where I picked up all this." "You were right. They'd been warned. They're all fine there. Kate says to carry on and Godspeed."
Emmy was beginning to understand how Kate felt. "But we didn't have time," she wanted to scream. But it was too late for that. The time was spent, and they could use the food. She had only so much chocolate in her bag.
"It was clever of you to think of food," she said as calmly as she could,
and knew she'd done the right thing when she saw Alice's shoulders relax.
"I've got the next bunch waiting for you."
The town was thick with English troops, setting up headquarters in Anne's beloved social center, pulling down the white and yellow curtains of which Anne was so proud, tossing aside her rag rugs. They were very understanding about Emmy coming in and collecting all the books and medical supplies. God bless, they told her, and good luck. Many of the men were familiar. These were the men with whom they'd watched the makeshift cinema in Ambleu, officers who had drunk tea in the barrack with them, and Tommies who had helped lay their duck walk. Soot-stained men now, scarred, bloody, battle-weary men, getting ready to fight again.
"Do you know if the Durham Light Infantry was in the battle?"
Emmy couldn't help asking as she piled books into her rucksack. Their captain shook his head. He was friends with Florence, Emmy knew. He'd loaned Florence his mare for riding, since he couldn't use it at the front. It was all such confusion. They came on us out of the mist. We never saw them coming.
He looked at Emmy, his face twisted in anguish.
They got our guns.
You'll get them back, said Emmy, as she might have to one of the children. If there's anything we Americans know about Old England, it's that you never let go of what you think is yours.
The captain mustered a weary grin.
And if there's anything we know about you Yanks, it's that you never let well enough alone. And thank goodness for it.
They both snapped upright as a dispatch rider hurried in.
Yes, what news?
What is it?
Emmy asked anxiously as the captain scanned the short message, his face going very, very still. Whatever it was, it couldn't be good. She mentally began to calculate how many loads they had left. Alice had gone 3 rounds so far.
We're to retreat,
he said, looking around at his weary men.
They're 5 miles away, or were half an hour ago. All right, men, onward.
From house to house, Emmy went, urging people out, trying to stay calm and reassuring, even as the sound of the guns became louder, knowing that every minute brought the Boche closer to Verlaine.
Would you like a book for the journey?
She asked, knowing that Nell would understand, that she wouldn't mind her books being given away. It broke Emmy's heart to see a 14-year-old boy hug a battered book of fairy tales close to his chest, holding tight to the book as he was forced to leave his home again, never knowing if he would ever come back or what there would be to come back to. Emmy hurried people to the town square, distributing milk and boiled eggs as they waited for Alice to return with the jitney, hunting up one woman's missing hens and another's misplaced sack of clothes, trying to guess how many more loads it would take, how many people they could fit on the jitney before the springs gave way. One elderly couple refused to leave. Emmy begged and pleaded, but they were obdurate.
My wife is ill, said Monsieur Philippot. She is dying. I cannot move her.
I'll take her on the mattress,
Emmy promised recklessly, hoping they could fit the mattress into the jitney. She'd deal with that when they came to it. Monsieur Philippot shook his head. He had been a prosperous man before the war, and his dignity hung around him like an old suit that was too large for his wasted frame.
This is our marriage bed, the bed in which our children were born. She cannot leave, and I will not leave her.
Emmy left them some milk and bread and begged them to come to the town square if they reconsidered. The jitney was loaded and loaded again, packed as full as the springs would bear, but it wasn't enough. They couldn't fit everyone on, especially not when Madame Lebrun refused to be separated from her prize hens. Emmy might have fought with her over it, but there was no point to it. They'd have to do another round anyway. It was a terrifying feeling watching Alice drive away, trying to be bright and cheerful for the group that remained, who all looked as terrified as Emmy felt. Emmy looked for her watch, which she always kept pinned to her breast, but it must have come off somewhere, abandoned with all the other debris of lives interrupted. Not knowing the time made it worse somehow. She was aware of time working against her, every minute stretching into hours as the shadows grew longer and the guns grew louder. A Boche plane flew so low over their heads that Emmy could see the black cross on the tail. How long did it take a German army to march? How much time did they have left? Even with books and toys scrounged from the social center, the adults were getting anxious, the children restless. Some were threatening to just return to their houses, others to take to the road by themselves. The British troops were marching out, all of them. Emmy had never felt anything like the fear that came with the sound of those retreating feet, knowing that at any moment they might be left to their own devices with the German army pushing down upon them. Where was Alice? The jitney rattled into the square, looking even more dilapidated than usual. Alice was covered head to toe with dust, her lace collar askew, thoroughly frazzled.
I didn't mean to take so long. The roads are nearly impassable. Everyone in the world seems to be going in both directions at once.
She looked down at Emmy, suppressed fear in her eyes.
One of the men told me they're sending every man they can to the front.
Emmy took a deep breath.
Can we fit everyone on, do you think?
The sun was setting already.
the village abandoned except for the Filippo, back there in their marriage bed, waiting for the Germans to come. Emmy just managed to cram everyone on, the jitney riding low on its sorely pressed springs. Somehow it moved, slowly, but it moved. The road from Verlaines to Erchoux had never been so lovely. It seemed unfair that it should be so beautiful, just now, when they had to leave it, when a German army was coming to wreck it all. The sky was rose and gold and purple over the fields they'd worked so hard to plow, those fields with all their promise. It was twilight, that most melancholy hour of the day. Her crazy rush of energy was gone. Emmy felt her spirits plummeting with the sun as the warmth of the day waned, leaving her cold and spent here in this broken-down truck filled with people who had lost their homes yet again, who they had tried so hard to help, only for it to come to this.
Mademoiselle Emmy?
It was one of her students, 9 years old, but suddenly very young again. Emmy could see she was trying not to cry, hugging a makeshift sack to her chest like a doll.
Mademoiselle Emmy, will we come home again?
As soon as the English get rid of the Boche for us,
Emmy said, trying to sound as encouraging as she could. But it was hard. It was so hard. She'd never seen anything so weary as the British troops they passed as they made the achingly slow journey from Verlaines to Erchoux. They were lovely, those troops. They moved aside to let the jitney go through, lifting their hats when they could, waving and raising ragged cheers.
Good old America,
called out one officer, lifting his cap to them as he and his men rumbled past in an open truck, and Emmy waved back, trying not to cry.
It's nice to be appreciated,
she said, to cheer herself as much as Alice.
Yes,
said Alice, looking worriedly over her shoulder. There were shells whizzing overhead, English shells aimed at the Germans.
But I'll be very glad to get back. They won't make it as far as Graycourt, will they?
They can't,
said Emmy. But they'd only just dropped that last group at Erchoux, painfully late, nearly 9, when they heard the rumble of a big gun coming from quite the wrong direction. It was dark now, full dark, the night broken only by the flashing lights of airplanes overhead, battling to the death. Emmy squinted into the darkness, feeling cold to the bone.
Did that come from Graycourt?
It can't be, said Alice, but she coaxed the jitney as fast as it could go. She made a little noise that was somewhere between a laugh and a sob.
I'd go faster if I could, but I'm not sure the poor old jitney could take it. They're all right. I'm sure they're all right.
It was impossible to think of the Germans at Graycourt, their Graycourt. This was their little bit of Smith in France, and to think of it being invaded was like trying to imagine the Germans marching their way into Northampton. Emmy harbored a momentary fantasy of a phalanx of professors fighting off the Germans, beating them off with umbrellas and Latin textbooks. There was an army camion stuck in the ditch by the gate, a British one. Emmy felt lightheaded with relief. She'd half expected to find the Germans there, ready to march them off into a German prison. This was a Graycourt transformed, dotted with lights, like something out of a fairy tale. People moving about, carrying flashlights, striking tents. The area around the moat was so thick with vehicles, Alice could barely get the truck through. It was like every tea and every dance they'd ever had multiplied by 10, the courtyard swarming with uniformed men, except that their guests didn't usually bring a giant anti-aircraft gun with them. Kate came hurrying out.
As you can see, we have visitors, about 200 of them.
She paused by the side of the jitney, working very hard at refraining from expressing alarm or concern or relief.
Alice said you were taking villagers from Verlaines. You got them all out?
All except Monsieur and Madame Philippot. They wouldn't go.
Emmy lowered herself out of the jitney, feeling about 100 years old, every muscle aching.
Poor Anne, we had to abandon her curtains, and I gave away Nell's books.
They'll understand, said Kate.
She started to reach for Emmy, and then let her hand fall.
I can't tell you how glad I am to have you back, both of you. Emmy swallowed hard and gave Kate a big hug, as if they were at Smith again, when life was simpler. In a muffled voice, she said,
"We heard the gun and thought Graycore was under siege."
Kate swiped at her eyes and gave a crooked smile.
"You could call it that. We have 200 hungry Tommies billeted on us. Julia is dealing with scratches and fevers, Nell is making up beds, and Anne is running the canteen. I've sent our Basque people on to Roi with Marie to boss them."
Some of Kate's brave facade crumpled.
"Celie may never forgive me for parting her from Minerva. She had to be carried, protesting, into the wagon. I felt like Lady Macbeth."
"It had to be done. They couldn't possibly have taken the goat with them. You can't imagine what the roads are like. You did it for her own good."
With all the khaki uniforms bustling about around them, their insignia indistinguishable in the darkness, Emmy couldn't help but ask,
"Will, Captain DeWitt, he's not here, is he?"
"No, he's not," said Kate with genuine regret. "He did come by this morning. He wanted to make sure we knew the Germans were coming. He came riding out of the mist like something out of one of your books. Young Lochinvar and the Scarlet Pimpernel all rolled into one. Poor man, it was utterly wasted on me. He pretended he was here for all of us, but it was you he wanted."
It was so hard when Kate was being kind.
"Did he leave any message for me? Did he say where he would be?"
"He had to go back to the line. He told me to tell you something about compasses," Kate added as an afterthought. "The points of the compass always come together in the end."
"It's John Donne," said Emmy, her throat scratchy. "A valediction, forbidding mourning. The two points of the compass always come together in the end, so true lovers can never really be parted, even when they run around in circles."
Except in the poem, the author was speaking about death. Emmy didn't want to think about death. It was all very well to talk about not loving as sublunary lovers love and expansion of souls and all that, but she'd really rather not have to commune with a soul. She wanted the whole person back. He'd been alive this morning, which meant he'd survived the dawn assault. But if he'd gone back to the line...
"There's been no word since?"
Kate shook her head.
"No one really seems to know anything, only that there was heavy fighting. You were closer to it than we were."
Emmy thought about the ambulances, those endless ambulances bearing their gruesome burden.
"I'm sorry," said Kate.
She couldn't let herself cry now, not when there was so much to be done. Will was away somewhere, but these men were still alive and needed her. Emmy blinked hard.
"What can I do?"
"You've done so much today already."
Kate saw the expression on Emmy's face and quickly changed whatever she had been about to say to,
"Anne could use the help. She's in the kitchen."
"We've been making gallons of tea," said Anne distractedly,
pushing a strand of ginger hair back behind her ear as Emmy poked through the canvas flap. Every pot they owned appeared to be in use, the big old stove smoking like anything.
"They've been without rations for 24 hours, these poor boys. We've been cooking and cooking for them since 3 o'clock. We've opened every can of beans in the place and boiled every scrap of macaroni we could find. But mostly it's tea they want, poor men. One nearly cried when I asked him if he wanted milk. He says he hasn't seen milk for months."
Emmy sliced bread and brewed tea and sliced more bread and brewed more tea, going back and forth to the dining room with tray after tray after tray as one group was fed and another came in. Work helped. It was easier not to think of Will out there in the mist with the Germans coming upon them when her hands were busy making up beds or carrying trays. They were so grateful, those men. Emmy, Anne, and Nell went back and forth between the kitchen and the dining room, cooking, collecting dishes, washing dishes, and filling them up again, while Florence saw to the animals, and Kate and Alice turned the dining room and the orangery into makeshift dormitories, stripping the mattresses and blankets off their beds to make pallets for the soldiers.
"Was that really the last of them?"
asked Anne, sitting down heavily on a stool, her feet sticking out in front of her. It was 2 in the morning, and everyone had been fed and put to bed, except the 7 remaining members of the Smith unit, who were collapsed in the kitchen, among a stack of dirty pots and dishes.
Merciful heavens, I hope so, said Nell, yawning. If I never see another tin of beans, it will be too soon.
Kate rubbed her eyes with the back of her hand.
They'll need breakfast.
Julia pushed herself off the wall against which she'd been leaning, half asleep on her feet.
We'd best get started then, hadn't we?
No, said Nell,
but Julia gave her a light shove.
If I can make oatmeal, said Julia, so can you.
Emmy had no idea what had happened between Julia and Kate in Paris, but whatever it was, she had never seen Julia pitch in like this before, like she was actually part of the unit and not just there for medical experience. Julia tucked up her sleeves and boiled and scoured with the rest of them. Her sharp-tongued jibes galvanized them into moving when they needed it, and Emmy didn't even mind the sting. Oatmeal. Cauldrons of oatmeal. Lakes of coffee. They left it all sitting in buffet form in the orangery and staggered down the duck walk to their barracks, only remembering just in time that they'd given up one barrack to offices, shoving Alice's and Florence's cots into Kate and Emmy's room. There was barely room to move between the cots and their bulging duffel bags.
You packed my duffel? Said Emmy, looking at Kate.
Just in case.
Kate paused for a moment and then added reluctantly,
The major said we should be ready to go if needed.
Their eyes met. They both knew what that meant.
They meant us to evacuate this morning, said Emmy. Alice and I just ignored them and carried on.
So did we. And then we weakened their resolve with tea and beans, said Kate. They were hardly going to insist once we started feeding them, but I doubt that will work again if the Germans come closer. We should get what sleep we can, while we can. Alice, what on earth are you doing?
Alice shoved another paper into the fire.
I'm burning my letters so the Germans won't get them.
Said Kate, nobly refraining from pointing out that the German infantry probably wasn't terribly concerned with Alice's private correspondence. Emmy had to tamp down an entirely ridiculous fit of the giggles at the thought of the Boche puzzling over Alice's letters from her sister, looking for codes in crochet patterns.
I've got the chickens in their crates, said Florence heartily as she plumped down on her own bed. And I've sent the cows and goats on to Moyencourt in care of Marie's son. We don't want the Boche to get them. Just a precaution, of course.
All just a precaution. They knew it wasn't, though. They'd moved past precaution somewhere around 9 that morning. Emmy lay down on the bare springs of her bed, pulling her coat over herself in lieu of a blanket. The mattress was currently on the floor of the dining room, as was the blanket, both being used by exhausted British soldiers who needed them far more than she did. She was still wearing the shirtwaist and uniform she had put on to teach a hygiene class in Verlaine a lifetime ago, before the world had exploded in blood and ash. In the silence, Emmy thought she could hear the sound of marching feet, the German army, thousands of them, bearing down on Greycourt, pitiless, unstoppable, laying waste to everything in its path like a beast from a child's nightmare.
Good night.
She whispered, and closed her eyes and tried to pretend it was yesterday, when Will was well, and all was well, and the Germans weren't marching inexorably toward them. Chapter 27
I was never afraid before I met you, but now I am. I know we said we wouldn't speak of the war, but the war is here. The war is coming for us. And I'm afraid as I was never afraid before, when there was only my own miserable life at stake. I'm afraid for you. I'm afraid for myself. I'm afraid I'll never see you again, never hear your voice again, never have the chance to tell you in my own weak, miserable words how much I love you. I've been trying to take solace in others' words. I have my John Donne here with me. Not Shakespeare, I promise, reminding me that our souls are joined even if our bodies are parted, circling like the points of a compass. I never told you that you are all the points of the compass to me, my east, my north, my south, my west, my America, my newfound land, my Emmy. I'm babbling now. I can't seem to think clearly in the midst of all this, and time is short. So if you can hear only one thing through the rubble and the noise, I hope you hear the echo of this. I love you. I love you. I love you.
From a letter, unsent, found among the things of Captain Fitzwilliam DeWitt, 2nd Battalion, Durham Light Infantry. March 1918. Grey Corps, France. They'd scarcely been asleep an hour when the guns started again. Kate struggled up, trying to make sense of where she was and what was happening. It was Grey Corps, but she was in her clothes, the room was jammed with extra cots, and the guns were rumbling nearer than she'd like. Feeling hot and cold all at once, Kate sat up, reaching for the coat-covered lump that was Emmy. Alice and Florence were already stirring, rubbing their eyes and pinning up their hair, but Kate knew from college that Emmy could sleep through just about anything, even, apparently, a machine gun barrage.
Emmy, Emmy.
Emmy grumbled, trying to stick her head under her pillow. There was a rat-a-tat-tat on the door, and the major entered, manfully averting his eyes, even though it was pitch dark and they were all fully clothed.
I'm awfully sorry, he said. But the Boche seemed to be on the move again.
Then I guess we ought to be too.
Kate's voice felt scratchy. It hurt to even think of leaving. But the guns, they were close. Closer than she had ever heard them. 3 miles away. 5 if they were lucky. She wondered what had fallen in the night. Which of their friends were dead.
We're already packed. We can be out in 15 minutes.
Alice stuffed her knuckles into her mouth, making a muffled sound of distress. Kate fished in her pocket, digging out a set of heavy keys.
Here.
She thrust them at the major.
These are the keys to the cellar. You'll find our supplies down there. Take anything you can use. Give any blankets and food to the soldiers and medical supplies to the hospital corps. As for anything that's left, if you have to retreat, burn it. Burn it all.
The seeds, said Alice faintly, and stopped. They'd all spent weeks sifting seeds into tiny little packets, thousands and thousands of them. Weeks of effort gone. All their hard-won supplies, all their Hague parcels, all the extras they'd wrangled from the Red Cross, gone.
What Kate said Emmy, heroically coming to Kate's aid. Her hair was out of its pins and half down around one shoulder. We'd rather lose everything than have it fall into the hands of the Boche.
I suppose so.
Said Alice, hugging her duffel to her chest.
It does seem a shame, though. Think of all those Nubias the Bangor Committee collected for us.
Oh, heavens, not the Nubias, said Florence. Even the Boche couldn't possibly want the Nubias.
What's a Nubia?
Asked the major, sounding so politely bewildered that Kate had to bite her lip to keep from laughing, or possibly crying.
I'm just going to take my duffel to the truck.
Kate said in a muffled voice, and staggered out before she could disgrace herself. Behind her, she could hear Alice explaining,
A Nubia is a sort of woolen hood. They're not worn very much anymore.
Ah, I see, said the major gravely, as if she were explaining a military tactic of utmost importance.
Kate paused just outside the barrack, her shoulders shaking, her chest tight. She was about to cry over the blasted Nubias, and she couldn't, not now, not when they needed her to be strong, even though she had no idea what she was doing, what she was meant to be doing. She wanted Mrs. Barrett. She wanted Dr. Stringfellow. She wanted anyone who could tell them what to do and where to go. Grey Corps looked different already. The anemones churned up by the tread of 200 soldiers, tents dotted around the lawn. Maybe, if she closed her eyes and wished hard enough, she could make it a week ago. The ground bright with flowers, slipping into story time and holding Zélie on her lap while Nell read to the Basque children in French about Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf, joking with the unit around the supper table about their amazing ability to differentiate between types of guns. But it wasn't a week ago. The Big Bad Wolf was here. He was on the march, with his big, big teeth and big, big guns, and maybe she wasn't the best the unit could have, but she was what they had right now.
Is it too heavy?
asked Emmy, coming out, lugging her own duffel. Kate fumbled for the bag, grateful for the pre-dawn dark that hid her face. No, just awkward. I can't seem to get a good grip. Outside the orangery, a surprise was waiting for her. All three trucks as spick and span as could be, the mud and dust of the previous day scrubbed off, everything oiled and greased and shining.
Did the Tommies do this for us? Asked Kate wonderingly.
I did, said Alice, heaving her duffel into the white truck with the hard tires they had acquired at such cost. Last night, while you were all cooking oatmeal, they're all greased and oiled and filled with essence, and there's extra essence in cans in each machine.
Kate goggled at her. How on earth did you get the gasoline?
Alice gave a little half shrug. They were packing up the supply dump in Om yesterday, so Emmy and I went along and asked them. They were really quite nice about it.
Nice didn't even begin to describe it. Kate hadn't even thought about fuel. There was so much she hadn't thought about.
Alice, you're a wonder.
Florence staggered up, holding a large crate in each hand.
I've got the hens. I thought we might need food for the people on the road, said Emmy breathlessly, bent nearly double, lugging 2 5-gallon drums of milk. I've packed our entire supply of milk and all the bread, biscuits, and chocolate I could find. The major has some Tommies carrying the rest of it over for us. I told him to put it in the jitney.
I've got first aid supplies and gas masks, said Julia briskly, swinging her doctor's bag into the back of the jitney.
I brought blankets, said Nell,
balancing a large pile of the aforementioned item on her head.
Someone is bound to need blankets.
And I've brought a portable stove, said Anne, and my tools, just in case we need them.
Kate felt her throat close up.
You're all wonders, she said.
She looked at the 6 other remaining members of the unit, huddled together around the trucks, each and every one of them a wonder, each and every one of them her sister. They had been strangers to each other when they arrived 7 months ago, but now she knew each of them down to the bones, just as they knew her, better than she had ever known anyone. The Tommies were loading the trucks, piling in the food and duffel bags and crates of hens. It felt horribly, dreadfully final. Kate drew herself up to her full 5'1", looking at all that remained of their unit.
They won't drive us away, she said fiercely. We're not leaving, not really. We're just stepping away for a bit. The Boche have no idea what they're up against in us.
One of Florence's roosters stuck his head out through the slats of his crate and let out a loud, defiant crow. It pierced the dawn, resounding over the guns and the thrum of the motors. Nell let out a shout of laughter.
Chanticleer agrees. Take that, Boche.
Even the unit's hens don't admit defeat, said Alice nobly. Nell, you're with me in the white truck?
That one's a rooster, actually, said Florence,
swinging up behind the wheel of the Ford truck. She grinned at Kate.
Mr. Buff Orpington himself.
You'll never let me forget that, will you? Asked Kate, settling herself behind the wheel of the jitney,
Emmy next to her and Julia behind. The major touched his hand to his cap.
Good luck. Godspeed.
And you, said Kate.
She had no idea what awaited him or them. All she knew was that all of them needed all the luck they could get. Luck and, what had Mrs. Rutherford called it? Grim determination. She nodded curtly at the major.
Kick those Boche back to Berlin for us.
The small procession of trucks bumped over the moat, through the great gates, down the long alley of fallen trees. Kate was glad she was driving. It kept her from craning her head back to look, to try to memorize it all. The ruin of the castle in the mist, the orangery where they had kept their trucks and held classes and their clinic and their parties. Marie's tumble-down house where she had cooked for them on her trusty stove before they had set up the kitchen. The church where they had sung their canticles and celebrated mass. Just a few days, Kate told herself. The British never let go of anything. And there were the foresters and the engineers and the aviators, all the men who had danced and come to supper and drunk soup out of their tooth mugs, all those brave men holding the line. But then they hit the road to Erschu and saw the soldiers, companies upon companies of them, dragging their way wearily down the road away from the front. There was a Scots band, their drums silent against their chests, their bagpipes furled. And somehow that struck Kate as the most haunting thing of all, their silence, when they had last seen them marching bravely toward the front with kilts swirling and bagpipes screeching. And alongside the retreat came the refugees, villagers from their own villages, villages from farther on, family groupings and people on their own, big sisters minding little siblings, an old woman clutching her cat, stumbling down the road in the pitiless light of the rising sun.
Stop! We have to do something for them. Can't we take them up?
Emmy pulled on Kate's sleeve. The sun was rising, burning off the mist, revealing all the horrors that had been softened by the dawn.
We'll have to drop our things and come back.
Kate didn't want to tell Emmy that she didn't like the noises the jitney had been making, but we can give them something to eat at least. They paused by the side of the road, handing out milk and bread and eggs to hungry children and soldiers, promising again and again that they would be back to take people up. Behind them, Florence honked.
We're blocking the road, she shouted. We need to get moving.
She's right, Kate said, as Emmy twisted to stare back at the new waves of villagers, more and more trailing out of the war zone.
We can set up in Hua at the Red Cross Hospital and ferry people back. We can do more that way.
It felt good to have a plan. They weren't running away, Kate decided. They were doing their job and would go on doing it. It made her feel less like a refugee herself. But when they got to Hua, a little after 6 in the morning, Dr. Baldwin was packing up the hospital.
We're evacuating,
he said, in between giving orders to harried orderlies.
We've been told to go on to Montdidier. It's not safe here anymore.
But surely they can't just be retreating, said Alice. They must mean to take a stand somewhere.
Dr. Baldwin paused, turning to face them.
The best I've heard is that the English have been forced out of their last trench. It's hand-to-hand combat now, in the open. The Germans are mowing down everything in their path.
Everything? Said Emmy, her face chalk white. But surely some of the men in the front lines, not everyone, can have been—
If they do take a stand, said the doctor, misunderstanding her concerns, it will be at the line of the old Battle of the Somme, which means we're on the wrong side of it. Let's hope there are enough left to hold the Germans there. In the meantime, we need to move our sick. We've mainly children here.
Kate turned to the rest of the unit.
We have two choices. We can take our things and move on, or we can stay and help.
Emmy was still pale, but resolute.
There's no question. We stay.
I always wanted a good story to tell my children, said Nell bravely.
Alice looked like she strongly wanted to disagree, but controlled herself.
Is it unanimous then? Asked Kate.
Even Alice nodded.
All right. We have 3 trucks and 7 of us. If we empty the trucks and leave all our bags here, we can use 1 truck to take the children from the hospital to Montdidier and the other 2 to go back and pick up as many people as we can.
I'll take the children,
volunteered Alice quickly, taking the job that involved driving away from the active fighting.
If they're evacuating Hua, we won't be able to use this as a base. We'll need some sort of refugee center in Montdidier.
Kate was struck by sudden inspiration.
Emmy, could you go with Alice and take charge of setting up a refugee center?
Yes, of course.
Emmy lifted her head, some color returning to her face.
If we can find a hotel to take us, we could use Nell's blankets for pallets and Anne's stove to heat milk for babies.
Brilliant. If you can organize that, Florence and I can take the other 2 trucks and ferry people from the villages between here and Erschu. Nell can come with me and Anne with Florence.
Alice was twisting her lace-edged handkerchief back and forth between her fingers, fear warring with conscience. Conscience won out.
It's a long way from Erschu to Montdidier. If you bring people here, I can run back and forth between Montdidier and Hua.
That will double the number of people we're able to move, said Kate gratefully.
Shall we?
The unit dispersed to their tasks, dumping their belongings in the courtyard of the hospital, distributing their remaining foodstuffs between the 3 trucks to share out among the refugees.
Florence looked mournfully at her chickens, but agreed there was no way to take them. They would have to be donated. Trust me, I mind as much as you, said Kate. After the trouble we had getting those horrible hens from Paris, I thought I was going to be pecked to death.
They can tell you don't like them, said Florence seriously.
I like them in soup, said Kate. But that was the last moment of levity they had for a long time. The day stretched on, endless, getting brighter and hotter. It felt like July on the road, and the dust rose in a choking cloud, coating their clothes and hair, sticking in the backs of their throats, mixing with sweat to make tracks of mud down their faces. Kate had never imagined anything like what they saw on the road that day, as they stopped and stopped and stopped again, loading as many people as they could into the truck, giving milk until the milk ran out, distributing every last scrap of bread they could find in their haversacks. There was an old man wheeling his paralyzed wife in a wheelbarrow. They made a pallet for her out of someone's mattress and got her into the truck, her husband next to her. Dispatch riders on motorbikes zoomed past them in both directions, raising more dust. Army camions lumbered past, and above it all, the guns thundered on, closer and closer. A colonel, they knew, honked from his truck, going the other way.
Don't stay too long, he shouted. We're going to blow the bridges up.
How long?
Nell shouted back, clinging to the side of the truck, but they couldn't hear the answer. As long as we can, Kate said grimly, and they went on, back toward the guns, back against the wave of people flowing in the opposite direction. Back and forth they went, back and forth along the road, picking up the people they had told to wait for them before, going into the villages past Roy and collecting anyone who looked like they might need help, which amounted to roughly everyone. It made Kate furious to think that these were the survivors. These were the few who had managed to remain after the first German invasion, to cling to their homes, to stay together, and here they were, on the road in the dust and confusion, with the Germans bearing down again, losing one another, losing everything. One woman was hysterical over a sack of clothing she had misplaced, all her smocks for her children, everything she had for them in the world. We'll look for them, Kate promised, because she knew the woman had to hear it, had to have something that was hers, even if the world was exploding into ash mile by mile and they had bigger problems than baby clothes.
It's one thing seeing the aftermath months later, said Kate soberly, as they dropped another group off at the hospital at Roy to be ferried on to Montdidier by Alice, and quite another to watch it in progress. All these people being wrenched from their homes. It's such a waste, said Nell, and climbed into the back to see how much food they had left to distribute. Half the people on the road were people they knew, people from their villages. All they'd done to make them comfortable again, lost. They'd tried so hard to give them some security, some hope, and now the best they could do was try to help them find a place where they could sleep on a floor for the night before being sent off to goodness knew where. Kate wondered how Emmy was getting on with the refugee center in Montdidier. She wished with all her soul that Emmy were here. Emmy was so much better than she was with people. She'd know what to say to a mother who had 9 children on 9 separate gun carriages, frantic with trying to collect them. She'd know what to say to the woman who refused to leave without her cat, which had run off. Nell was unflaggingly cheerful, a brittle sort of cheerfulness that might shatter any second, but the children responded to it and followed her, and Kate was insanely grateful to have her along, jollying the children and comforting the adults as Kate drove the truck. They picked up an 11-year-old girl, a loaf of bread sticking out from under each arm, her hands holding tight to 2 little sisters, 1 on each side. She refused to be parted from either bread or sisters until they promised they only meant to help them up into the truck together. They'd lost their mother, who was blind, and 2 little brothers, who were with their mother, in the confusion of the evacuation.
We'll see what we can do about finding her for you, said Nell cheerfully, and then crawled over the baggage piled high in the back of the jitney to Kate in the front.
Kate, we have to find some way of getting families back together. We have no idea who Florence and Anne have picked up. These girls' mother might be in her load.
What about the crossroads? We're dropping them there to wait for Alice anyway. We can set up a reunification center.
Kate scrubbed her forehead with a dusty hand. Most of them knew only the people in their assigned villages, but Anne, with her special carpentry and sewing classes, knew pretty much every child in all of them.
If Florence can spare Anne, she can do it. She knows more of these children than anyone.
The next time the two trucks met outside Hua, Kate shouted her plans across. Anne began sorting families by the crossroads, and Florence went off alone, down the road to Marny.
Be careful!
Kate shouted after her, and Florence waved her hat at her in response as the dust rose in her wake. Kate was putting the jitney into gear when a sentry hailed them.
Is something wrong?
Asked Kate, and then realized what an idiot question it was. Of course something was wrong. Everything was wrong.
It's Albert, isn't it?
Nell called down.
You directed the traffic for us in Om.
Yes, miss,
said the sentry, showing crooked teeth as he grinned at Nell.
Well, you see, it's like this. They want me to guard the Nell Raw Road, but someone's needed to direct traffic here.
I've always wanted to direct traffic,
said Nell, putting on her old ebullience like a cloak. She stood up in the jitney, shaking out her dusty skirt.
It's a lifelong ambition of mine. You'll be all right without me, Kate.
Right as rain, lied Kate in the same cheerful tone, and left Nell standing at the crossroads, moving her arms left and right, shouting at camions and scolding cart drivers. Kate's shoulders were stiff and aching from fighting with the jitney. There was something wrong with it. She'd have to get Alice to look at it later. But there wasn't time now. Every minute counted. Every minute meant another person saved. It was harder without Nell, so much harder, and she was painfully aware of time passing, of the sun moving and the shadows gathering and the Germans coming on and on, unstoppable. Madame Chevrier from Bacquancourt wanted her to tell Emmy that she had saved the curtains she was making for the social center in Canisy. Kate congratulated her and tried not to think that there probably wasn't a social center left for curtains. She couldn't let herself think like that. A British soldier blocked her on the road to Erchou.
It's not safe anymore, miss. You can't go that way. The Boche.
Had they got everyone out? Kate hoped so. Her cheeks stung with sunburn and her eyes with dust as she drove the last load back to the crossroads. She found Alice there, helping Anne get families into the white truck.
They say it's not safe to keep going back, said Alice anxiously. Florence has gone on to Montdidier with the truck.
Does anyone know what's going on? Asked Kate in frustration.
Alice shook her head.
Only that they're closer.
How much closer? What did that even mean? Kate was sick of rumors and half news, of not knowing what was going on. She felt as if she were in a snow globe, being shaken about while someone was peering in from outside, watching her dance.
All right, said Kate hoarsely.
She was stiff and grimy, and she hadn't realized it before, sick with hunger. Her watch said it was past 7. She had been driving for 13 hours straight.
We'll regroup in Montdidier.
They left Anne and Nell, Nell still directing traffic, Anne staying to keep her company.
It's all right,
Anne promised them as Kate took up her last load of refugees.
Dr. Baldwin says he'll take us to Montdidier with him when he finishes closing down the hospital.
In Montdidier, Kate found that Emmy had taken over a hotel.
The owner has been splendid, said Emmy. She's let us have the whole building and found us straw for pallets. Julia's taken over a room for a children's infirmary. Mrs. Goodale, she's one of Dr. Baldwin's nurses, got on to someone she knew and came back with a regular bonanza of condensed milk for us, so we've been able to feed the babies now that we don't have our cows anymore.
Emmy. Kate looked around, dazed and amazed. There was a full canteen running in the courtyard and rooms lined with pallets like dormitories.
How on earth did you do all this in one day?
Emmy flushed, looking pleased and flustered.
It wasn't just me.
Some of our Quakers from Om came by and have been helping. We managed to find enough stoves to make sure everyone's had some warm food. There's a schoolmistress who let us have the stove from her school, and someone else donated tables and chairs for a canteen in the courtyard.
Is that Marie?
One of the groups clustered around a table in the courtyard looked awfully familiar.
Yes, Florence brought our Basque people in just an hour ago. Oh dear. Yes, what is it?
One of the Quakers needed Emmy. She gave an apologetic wave and bustled away, leaving Kate to Marie, who embraced and scolded her all at once, wanting to know what Kate had been doing to get her uniform into such a state, and after Marie had washed it so nicely for her, too.
But weren't you... You left on Friday, said Kate dazedly.
It belatedly dawned on her that Friday had been yesterday. It couldn't possibly have been only yesterday. Yesterday morning, they had still been going about their business. That couldn't be right. But it was.
You ought to have been here ages ago. What happened?
They hadn't really thought the Germans would come, so they'd gone only as far as Moyencourt. But then, with the morning, they'd been told they had to go, so they had joined the other refugees on the road and might have made it faster, but there had been that trouble with Zaylee.
What trouble?
Kate wasn't tired anymore. She was suddenly, desperately scared. She could see all the other Basque residents eating in the courtyard, but not Zaylee.
Where's Zaylee?
It was that goat, said Marie defensively. My son brought the animals to Moyencourt, but we couldn't bring them further, so we went on without them. But that Zaylee, she ran off when no one was looking.
Ran off? After the goat?
Marie stepped back, folding her arms across her chest.
I always told you that goat would be trouble, treating it like a pet. Now you see what happened.
Where did she go? Back to Moyencourt?
Kate could see the map of their villages in her head with horrible clarity. Moyencourt was farther from the front than Greycourt, but not by much, not nearly enough.
She's probably sleeping in a barn somewhere with that goat, said Marie.
But she didn't sound sure. Alone, in Moyencourt. Kate didn't stop to think. She grabbed a piece of bread from the table. She had water in a thermos in the truck.
If anyone asks, I've just gone on one last run.